This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
As Japan suffers multiple reactor accidents with radiation of the land and sea, sadly one woman is vindicated again. Dr. Helen Caldicott is a physician, author, and speaker known throughout the world for her clear warnings about the dangers of both nuclear weapons and nuclear power. Helen Caldicott woke us up with the film and book If You Love This Planet, now the title of her own weekly radio show. I'm Alex Smith, host of Radio EcoShock. Dr. Caldicott, I am honored to welcome you to this program.
Thank you, Alex.
Let's get right to work. What would you like to tell the world about the nuclear disasters in Japan following the earthquake and tsunami on March 11th?
Well, what can I say? Fancy building six rather faulty General Electric Mark I reactors upon an earthquake fault. Japan has been known forever as to having earthquakes. The disaster is not finished. It's ongoing. In fact, nobody can predict how long it will go. I mean, I don't know. It could go on for years. If there is a very large release of radiation or a meltdown and the wind's blowing over Japan, it's only a tiny, tiny country. That could be it. I mean, Chernobyl, which had only been operating for 3 months, has devastated 40% of the European landmass. The food grown there will be radioactive for hundreds of years. And the New York Academy of Sciences document has just reported that almost 1 million people have died from Chernobyl. Here we have six reactors, we have six cooling pools, and another two very large cooling pools, all of which are at risk, and there's far more radiation in each of the cooling pools than there is in each reactor itself. So it takes my breath away when I really just first realized what the significance could mean. It's extremely serious, and I have to tell you, I think it means the end of the nuclear industry, thank God, and the end of uranium mining, and maybe the human race will extrapolate further and realize they must abolish nuclear weapons at long last.
And perhaps it could be the beginning of real, earnest efforts to develop clean energy.
Oh, yes. I mean, look at Canada. You've got huge amounts of geothermal energy. You're blown by wind everywhere, but I think Alberta's very wind-blown. And even in the middle of winter, you've got enough sun to solarize, you know, every single house in Canada. And it will employ hundreds of thousands of people. The GDP will go up, and everyone will feel really good with themselves.
At the first announcements of the problems at this Fukushima Daiichi complex, there was a chorus of soothing denial from nuclear boosters, including Dr. Barry Brook in Australia, I might add.
Oh, don't even talk about him.
And from the Japanese.
He's a statistician. He doesn't even know any biology, genetics, or medicine. And he has no right to talk the way he talks.
Well, we're told everything would be fixed. There was no health risk. Why did it take so many days before the real situation was reported?
I realized immediately, and in fact, many people did. I've had so many emails, I'm just overwhelmed, and Facebooks and all sorts of stuff. Those who understood deeply within themselves about nuclear energy knew immediately what it meant. The nuclear industry was struggling to put a spin on it. They had all their spin doctors out, and of course, they've got millions of dollars behind them, but it's becoming more and more apparent that they're going to get nowhere. What really aggravates me, though, is that they say the levels of radiation are low. You know, no immediate harm, no. But if you inhale or ingest these radioactive particles, the strontium-90, cesium-137, radioactive iodine, etc., you won't get your leukemia for 5 years. So, you know, there is no immediate danger, per se. Immediate danger means those poor fellows in the reactor vessels trying to do something, and they're dead men walking. Many of them are going to be dead within 2 weeks of acute radiation illness. So they're in immediate danger. Everyone else is in long-term danger of getting either leukemia, cancer, or having their genes mutated in their testicles and ovaries to affect future generations.
Yes, and we saw after Chernobyl the way that people were shunned who came from there. People didn't want to marry them. People didn't even want them around. They thought they might have radioactivity on their clothes. We're going to see that again with these Fukushima evacuees who may never be able to go home. What do you think their situation is?
Well, it's so ironic, you know, and tragic, because Hibakusha in Hiroshima and Nagasaki were in exactly the same position. The Atomic Bomb Casualty Commission, run by the US, who dropped the bombs, study these people voraciously to find out what happened to them, because they were the guinea pigs, but they never got any treatment. And people shunned them. They got cancers in large numbers. No one wanted to marry them because their genes may have been affected and mutated. So Chernobyl, yes, the same. And here we again have another absolute disaster, which, you know, if it really is ongoing, is going to contaminate the whole of the Northern Hemisphere, as did Chernobyl.
In fact, we've received radiation here in British Columbia and along the West Coast, but it's also been measured in Iceland, having arrived from Fukushima.
Oh, really?
So it at now very low amounts, they say, but they can find that signature. So it is moving around the Northern Hemisphere as we speak.
Well, when they say low amount, you know, you need 1/1,000,000th of a gram of plutonium inhaled into your lung to give you cancer. So it's they're measuring the external gamma radiation running around with Geiger counters, but that doesn't give you any indication at all of the kind of isotopes which make up the radiation that they're measuring. So they don't know what they're talking about.
That is part of my next question, and it involves your expertise as a medical doctor. The released radiation is being compared to chest x-rays or a CT scan, but I thought that radioactive particles ingested in your food or breathed in from the air acted differently in your body from the radiation coming from outside. Can you clear up that confusion for us?
I can, yes. There are about 200 new elements made when you fission uranium in a reactor, all of which are radioactive and man-made. Some last seconds and some last millions of years. Now, many of them emit gamma radiation like X-rays, but many do not. So when they're measuring the external dose, in other words, if you're enveloped in a cloud of radioactive elements, you'll get an external dose like an X-ray. But the most important thing for everyone to understand is if you inhale plutonium or americium or curium or radioactive iodine, if the elements become bioconcentrated at each step of the food chain, algae, crustaceans, little fish, big fish, humans, or in the plants, the lettuce, the spinach, into the milk from the grass and the cows, then you are getting inside your body these elements that locate, for instance, on bone, strontium-90, which is a very, very, very tiny amount, can mutate a single regulatory gene in a single cell to give you leukemia 5 years later or cancer 15 years later. And that applies to all of them. So people do not understand the difference between vaguely measuring some external dose from internal emitters. And that's what you all have to understand, internal emitters. And I go into that in my two books, Nuclear Madness, and the one that recently came out called Nuclear Power is Not the Answer to Global Warming, so you will understand.
We've also learned, many of us, for the first time, that so-called spent nuclear fuel is extremely dangerous. Tell us about those pools of nuclear waste.
Every year they remove 1/3 of the fuel rods from the reactors because they're so, so thermally hot and radioactively hot, and they're inefficient for the reaction anymore, and they're called spent fuel. They're put in cooling pools, which euphemistically the industry calls swimming pools. And you see 30 tons are removed every year, and so they've got 6 reactors there. A few of them are 40 years old and a few of them about 35 years old. Can you imagine how much radioactive stuff they've got in those fuel pools? Now, the very short-lived isotopes have decayed away to nothing, but the long-lived ones, the very dangerous ones, cesium, strontium, uranium, plutonium, americium, curium, neptunium, I mean, really dangerous ones, the long-lived ones, that's what the fuel pools hold. And there was a study done by von Hippel et al. At Princeton to show if a spent fuel pool went, it would just produce the most enormous amount of damage, far, far worse than a meltdown like Chernobyl in a reactor core.
And Dr. David Lockbaum from the Union of Concerned Scientists reported the spent fuel ponds in the United States pose the same risks as at Fukushima. He said most of the cooling pumps for these pools are not even connected to diesel backup generators, and none of them have battery backup power. Can you talk to us about those risks for American nuclear power plants?
Well, I mean, it's the same as in Japan. I mean, God Almighty, David is an absolutely magnificent fellow who helped write the Generation 4 reactor chapter in my latest book. But I did not know that there weren't emergency cooling pumps for the spent fuel pools, backup diesel generators or batteries. I did not know that. I mean, how alarmingly irresponsible of the industry. These guys are engineers, and often engineers, you know, they work for the worst case possibility, i.e., what is the weakest point in the bridge, therefore will make the bridge safe. But they overlook most obvious problems. I think it's a sort of an industry which these particular men love because it's the power of the atom, and they just sort of love playing around with that, like people like driving racing cars and things. Do you know what I mean? I think there's a psychology behind it which is very strange to me as a physician.
And I want to report to you and to the listeners, I've just listened to NHK World Television, and they've reported that the Tokyo drinking water has been found to contain iodine and that it's not recommended for feeding babies anymore. And they believe that that got into the water system through polluted rivers. And a professor has measured soil 40 kilometers north of the plant, found radiation 5 centimeters deep, and says that will last in the soil for at least 30 years. So I think it's time now that we can say that a large part of Japan has been damaged by this accident and may not recover.
Well, it won't recover. I mean, these accidents go on forever because plutonium's half-life is 24,400 years. It lasts for 500,000 years. 30 tons of plutonium got out at Chernobyl. And then cesium-137, its half-life is 30 years. It lasts for 600 years. The same with strontium-90, and I could go on and on down the periodic table of the lists of all the elements. So this is ongoing, and not what's more, if a man's genes are mutated in his testicles by plutonium, which has a particular predilection for testicles, then the genes, the damaged genes, are transmitted generation to generation while the plutonium lives on, and if the man gets cremated, can be inhaled by another man and get into his testicles ad infinitum. So you could see an exponential increase in genetic disease. There are now 2,600 such diseases like diabetes, cystic fibrosis, dwarfism, and the like. My specialty is cystic fibrosis. And they will increase in frequency down the generations, and that's the legacy we leave. Random, compulsory genetic engineering for the rest of time.
Looking at the world picture, is it accurate to say that the majority of the world's nuclear reactors are situated by the ocean within range of large tsunamis?
Yes, but they're also on lakes. Lake Ontario has quite a lot. In fact, I'm going to the Darlings and hearings tomorrow for my sins. What am I going to say to them? Are you really psychotic? You want to build two more reactors on Lake Ontario, just near Port Hope, which is built on radioactive tailings? What am I going to say to them as a physician?
Well, those plants, they said they were going to cost about $6 billion, and now the new estimate is $36 billion. It doesn't seem to matter what the price tag is. We just have to build them. Why? Why?
Well, it's the same way that they built nuclear weapons. You know, I called one of my first books Missile Envy, a la Freud. And that's what it is. I think that the etiology or the cause of this nuclear illness is the reptilian midbrain of some men's minds. And it's very interesting to read about the latest physiology of the brain, the limbic system, which produces a hormone which is rather like morphia. The two instincts which generate that wonderful hormone that makes you feel terrific in men are sex and violence. So intrinsic in nuclear weapons, and nuclear power is just an offshoot of nuclear weapons, it's the same technology, is violence.
And this is possibly resulting from a brain problem.
It's not a brain problem, it's just a normal physiological problem that we evolved with since we lived in caves, I think.
Right. I'd like to talk for a minute about President Barack Obama. You know, before he announced his candidacy, we saw prominent press coverage of his visit to a nuclear plant in Ohio. We've since learned his campaign received substantial money from nuclear power companies like Exelon, and he appointed a pro-nuclear energy secretary, physicist Stephen Chu, and they're all backing more nuclear power even after this accident. Where do you see Barack Obama on nuclear power?
Oh, look, I'm sorry. I really had such hope for the man. He's so intelligent, such a fine human being. But he's being co-opted by these nuclear people. And I heard that when he was in Chile, even after the Fukushima accident, he signed an agreement to sell Chile reactors. Now, I can't confirm that, but I did hear it. I'm sorry, but I've lost faith in Obama, which is an absolute tragedy.
And the second argument that's advanced is that everyone in Asia deserves the benefits of lights, refrigeration, the lifestyle we enjoy. If energy-hungry countries like China and India don't build lots of nuclear power plants, they will use coal, adding to climate suicide. What is your reply?
Well, they'll also get the benefits of cancer, leukemia, deformed babies, children with genetic disease for generations hence. That's a good idea too, isn't it? This is all medical. It's like when we doctors started talking about the medical effects of nuclear war, the press was stunned. They said, what are you talking about this for? This is, you know, it's national defense and security and army generals and war. And we started to describe the effect of a bomb dropping on Boston, people being vaporized out to 5 miles and third degree burns out to 20 miles and the like. And suddenly people woke up and said, oh, my God, nuclear war is bad for our health. This is all about medicine. Nuclear power poses the greatest public health hazard the world will ever see, period.
Even greater than coal, you would argue?
Oh, far, far greater, yes. But then again, coal must be stopped being burnt as we speak. You must not be digging up your coal tar sands. That's a terrible thing to do. And we've got to stop burning carbon. So I commissioned a study some years ago called Carbon Free, Nuclear Free by a brilliant physicist called Arjun Makajani. You can find it at ieer.org. The present renewable technology, which is very cheap, can supply all the energy America needs by 2040.
And now we find that America is saddled with 40-year-old technology, but nobody seems to be able to close a nuclear plant and clean up the mess. Can you talk to us about decommissioning?
Well, to decommission a reactor, you have to wait until it cools, radioactively cools down for about 40 years until anyone can get near it. It's actually has to be taken apart by robots, by remote control. It's so radioactive. And then it's got to be taken somewhere. In other words, you can never get rid of nuclear waste. You just transport it from one place to another, exposing more and more and more workers, usually men, and their testicles, and therefore future generations, to more and more and more radiation. A very big, large nuclear reactor has never been decommissioned.
And I've been told that the cost of doing so, even if we could, would be as much as building the plant in the first place.
That's correct, or even more. And I write about decommissioning and the cost in my book, Nuclear Power's Not the Answer.
Right. Talk to us for a minute about that book, would you? I think it's really important.
Well, the first chapter deals with the fact that nuclear power in its own right induces a huge amount of global warming gas because it relies upon a vast industrial infrastructure, mining millions of tons of uranium. And you know about that in Canada. Your uranium was used for Trinity, Fat Man and Little Boy, the first three bombs that were ever exploded on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. It was used for all the bombs America built till 1957. So you know about that. Then you have to crush millions of tons of uranium into a fine powdered dust. And then you have to extract the uranium itself from the soil that's been mined. Then you have to enrich the uranium, and that's enriched. Well, first, uranium hexafluoride is formed at Port Hope at the Cameco plant, then sent to Paducah, Kentucky, where they use two huge coal-fired plants to enrich the uranium. So at every step of the fuel chain, large quantities of global warming gas are formed. Then the next chapter is on the cost. and the hidden costs and the support of the government. You can't buy insurance against nuclear power. The government covers it, but not nearly enough. And it's called the Price-Anderson Act in America. But most of it goes back to the utility, not to people who are dead and dying, or families are. The next chapter deals with the basic fundamentals of radiation and how internal emitters cause cancer and how they cause genetic disease. Just a basic first-year medical lecture, but easy to understand. And then I go into first, second, third and fourth generation reactors. I go into the industry and how it continually lies and obfuscates information. Then I go into what people can do about it, I think. It's a quick read, but if you know the data in that book, you'll be able to argue with anyone, including Prime Minister Harper, and beat him.
And the title is?
Nuclear Power is Not the Answer to Global Warming, and it's published by The New Press.
Right. Well, now, back in Tokyo, we find the Tokyo Power Company has announced rolling blackouts will continue into May and then reappear in the summer when air conditioning season appears. With the multiple nuclear plants shut down, the utility says it does not have enough electricity to support full manufacturing in Japan. So it looks like depending on nuclear power can severely damage your economy once an accident like this happens.
Correct. Yes, I think this is going to be the end of Japan as an economic giant. If there's a real meltdown, like Chernobyl, and blows over Japan, that's the end of Japan. That is the end of Japan.
Yes, it is a small island, and I've always thought that France is threatened by just such a complete breakdown. They've got 75%, I think, of their power coming from nuclear. If something irradiated that beautiful country and the public revolt, how would France even begin to cope?
Well, you know, every corner you turn in France is a huge cooling tower. And the French love their food, their wine, their cheese, you know. It's radioactive, some of it, because nuclear power plants, as they operate normally, routinely emit radioactive elements into the air and water all the time. And then often there are accidents and they emit much more radiation than they plan to do. The French, I've got a French son-in-law who's a count, they tend to be pretty arrogant. They are terribly ignorant because the French reactors were all built by the French government. Le Monde was kind of run by the French government, their newspaper, and they don't know anything about nuclear power, but they're learning, by God. I mean, it's a disaster. Look, nuclear power makes war obsolete. Europe's covered with nuclear reactors. If the Second World War was fought today, Europe would be uninhabitable for the rest of time. And that holds true for the rest of time because even if the reactors are shut down, you've got all these huge, huge pools full of thousands, hundreds of thousands of tons of radioactive waste, which lasts forever, forever.
I'm Alex Smith with famous anti-nuclear spokeswoman Helen Caldicott as we face nuclear fear in Japan. Already, Helen, American companies are saying new nuclear plants may not be financially feasible in Texas, Maryland, and other places. One CEO said it's been stalled for another decade anyway by falling prices of natural gas. It isn't even competitive with solar these days. Realistically now, Helen Caldicott, what do you see happening in the nuclear industry?
Oh, I think it's the end, as I said earlier in the program. It's the end of the nuclear industry. As soon as I heard about this accident, that's what I thought. It's the end. It's the end of uranium mining. Thank God. And I said I've been doing this crazy work for 40 years. I said all that time it will take a major meltdown to end the industry. And here we have it, not one. We've got six possible meltdowns and cooling pools as well.
Where should anti-nuclear campaigners focus now? What are the key places and issues?
Look, go to my webpage called nuclearfreeplanet.org and you'll get a huge amount of information. I've also got a Facebook, Dr. Helen Caldicott, and we post every up-to-date article we can find so that you'll learn all about it. So information is ammunition. Jefferson said an informed democracy will behave in a responsible fashion. You know, we've got to have a revolution, a nuclear revolution. against nuclear psychosis, and that means doing an Egypt or a Wisconsin or, you know, what we did in the 80s to try and end the nuclear arms race, millions and millions of us. So it's got to be peaceful and sagacious and dignified, but we can do that.
On a personal level, Helen, what have you been up to lately?
Oh, well, I'm doing a trip now. I've just been up to Montreal for a speech. I'm now in Boston having a day of rest. Tomorrow I go to the Darlington hearings. I go to Ottawa, probably for a press conference and a talk at a hospital to doctors. And on Saturday there is a very large day-long conference with me and many other of my colleagues talking about the medical effects of just what we've been discussing in Ottawa. If you go to the Global Physicians for Survival webpage, you'll find where this conference is and you can come to it. I have a radio program which is a weekly thing called If You Love This Planet that should play on every station in every country at the moment, I suppose, because it's mostly focused upon, well, global warming and nuclear power and weapons and the medical implications. And my webpage really is an outreach to the younger generation who know absolutely nothing about nuclear because they grew up without knowing about it. But they're Facebooking it and they're Twittering it and all of that stuff. So I'm hoping to get into their hearts and souls and brains. And I think now with this catastrophe, that will happen.
As we wrap up, is there something else you would want listeners to know?
I would want the Canadians to stand up and do the right thing. They're fine, good, honest, decent people. Now get going. Stop sitting in front of your computers and get out there and stop this madness. You are one of the major suppliers of uranium to the world. Cameco of Port Hope supplies the whole world with nuclear fuel rods made at Port Hope. So stop it. Close Cameco down, period. You export two things. You export wheat for life and you export uranium for death.
And you know, more than half of our listeners now are Americans. How about them?
Americans, you know, deep in your hearts and souls, you must close down all the nuclear reactors. If you can't do it overnight, do it next week. No, I'm really serious. This is a matter of extreme medical urgency. You've got the message. Do it.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. It's been my honor to interview Dr. Helen Caldicott, who is simply the strongest voice for sanity for nuclear affairs for almost four decades. Our website is ecoshock.org, but more importantly, follow Helen through her website, helencaldicott.com, and her weekly radio show at ifyoulovethisplanet.org. Dr. Caldicott, thank you for sharing your valuable time with us.
Thank you, Alex.
This is Alex Smith. As this program goes to air, the situation at the Fukushima Daiichi reactor remains critical, almost 2 weeks after the initial earthquake and tsunami. On Thursday in Japan, NHK World Television reports some lights were turned on in the control room of Reactor 3 and in Reactor 2. This allowed workers a quick chance to look at some of the temperature and pressure gauges. Photos have been released from inside one reactor building, and the control room suffered significant damage, possibly from later explosions inside the plant. Workers had to evacuate several times that day due to high radiation, continuing smoke from some reactors, and abnormal temperatures within others. And there were two strong earthquakes measuring up to 6.0 on the Richter scale. Japanese television reports reactor number one was overheated, reaching over 400 degrees centigrade, 100 degrees hotter than design specifications. Smoke continued from reactor number three, the cause unknown. If the source is exposed fuel rods, that reactor contains some plutonium. It's a major worry. The exodus of residents from Tokyo toward the southern part of the country continues, including evacuation of consulate workers from more than a dozen countries. I'm Alex Smith. Radio EcoShock will return in 1 minute. We will help you deal with headline shock as we talk with peak oil psychologist Karen McMahon. She lives just 35 miles from an aging nuclear plant in New England that is coming up for a license renewal. Stay tuned.
Tokyo Electric Power Company evacuated workers after black smoke rose from the number 3 reactor building on Wednesday afternoon. You're watching NHK World, and this is Newsline for 9 a.m. Japan time. The video footage from the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear power plant shows what appears to be steam or smoke rising from four reactor buildings on a Thursday morning. For the first time, what appears to be steam can be seen rising from the number one reactor building. Smoke or steam can also be seen rising from the buildings of the number two, number three, and number four reactors.
And this is a nursery in Setagaya Ward. People here will have to prepare a baby formula using water. However, the staff here are having a difficult time trying to secure water. After hearing the news, the staff went around supermarkets trying to find bottled water. However, they went to four stores but could not find enough water for the children.
You're listening to Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
As I see Japanese faces looking lost in demolished towns, searching for loved ones, it hurts me too. Slivers of nuclear dust have reached the west coast of North America, and we are already extra jumpy here about earthquakes and tidal waves. We've seen them both, and scientists promise the big one is just waiting to happen. Add in grumpy, broke citizens all across the country paying a lot more at the grocery store and the gas pumps, and well, some of us might need a little counseling. That's why I'm calling up Kathy McMahon, a practicing psychologist who helps people cope with challenging times. Our previous interview remains in the top 10 of Radio EcoShock downloads. Kathy, welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
Oh, it's my pleasure to be here.
Kathy, with the new war, video of calamity, a big dose of nuclear fear, the news is a lot to take these days, isn't it?
It sure is. It's pretty scary, and I think it just keeps coming, which is the hard part for a lot of us. We don't quite know what to focus on or what to be concerned about first.
And we don't have time to digest it.
Absolutely.
You know, when I was young in the Los Angeles area, I experienced the earthquake of 1971. There were over 100 killed, the freeway bridges and a hospital collapsed, natural gas lines ripped open and burned for 3 days. I've never forgotten it. I wonder if these big events change us permanently inside.
You know, it's a good question. I think that we never obviously forget when we see horror. It's one of the things that sticks with us. But the thing that reminds me that this is not out of the realm of possibility is that humans have always faced nature, and dead on, and even much closer than we do now. We have a sort of a safe distance that many of us in the West look at nature through, sort of the large picture window that keeps us safe and protected, or at least with that feeling that we're somehow safe and protected. So I think that despite the fact that, yeah, I agree with you that we feel a tremendous amount of horror, we also have this sort of built-in mechanism that helps us to be resilient to accepting that horror is something that happens to humans. And I'm starting to think that maybe modern industrial man might actually be more in shock as a result of it because we've had so little experience in actually facing it. We've been buffered in so many situations, so many of us.
Although we've seen a lot of it in the movies and our media, so that maybe also made us a little buffered.
Well, except that it's one thing to watch it in a movie because at the end, it all sort of pretty much turns out pretty well and we all kind of go home. But, you know, the people in Japan right now, in northern Japan, aren't going home. And they're actually living with the catastrophe all around them. And that face-to-face reaction to that trauma is so much more dramatic than it is just vicariously experiencing it. It. You know, it has a small effect, but I think certainly being there and watching just the simple scale of it all is much more overwhelming emotionally to us.
Scientific studies show the number of so-called natural disasters, including such things as monster hurricanes, the floods, and the fires, are definitely increasing, and insurance companies agree. Health professional Dr. Paul Epstein, I've just been reading his new book that's coming out. He says we're seeing an epidemic of epidemics. Are we going to trust nature less, and what does that mean for us if that is the case?
Well, trust is an interesting word, And I think, again, that it has to, my opinion is that we, as you know, Western folks, have been used to looking out at nature as kind of an amusement park. And we've been used to believing that we could buffer ourselves from the full effect that nature has on us. And so I think what's happening is that as these catastrophes are increasing in volume, they're affecting more and more of us. And certainly, I know, looking at what's happening in Japan, we think of Japan as such an advanced civilization, and we look around at the pictures that are going on in the island, and we suddenly realize, wait a minute, they're just a little island, and we're all little people. And so I think it does impact us on that level, but I think a lot of it has to do with the fact that we've gotten used to thinking of ourselves as kings of the universes or queens of the universe. And I think that disasters like this that really smack us in the face remind us that we, in fact, are pretty helpless in many, many situations over nature. We don't control it. We're just a part of it.
Well, you've kind of answered my next question. I was thinking along the lines of distrust that people don't believe what the government is saying and they don't believe what the media is saying or what corporations say. And I was going to ask, you know, are we modern humans changing fundamentally to a more suspicious or fearful state? But you're calling up an image of primitive humanity where we were perhaps always wary as we walked through the jungle that something might get us.
And we always should have been. Because, again, we were constantly reminded of our interdependence with the world around us and that we could not control everything. In modern life, we have such a conviction that we have control over everything because we do these remarkable things we don't think a moment about. We hit a switch and light comes on and fills the room. We turn a button and suddenly we get heat. I mean, these are just phenomenal accomplishments that we don't even think about, we don't even consider, and we don't assume anymore that we should be cold in the winter or hot in the summer. We don't assume that we should face incredible discomfort and survive through it. So, yeah, I think that modern humans in some ways are more vulnerable than ancient man because of our expectations. And I think what we're seeing now, Alex, is we're having repeated experiences of violated expectations, which are really shocking to so many of us.
Kathy, you and I think community building and transition is the best answer to large-scale troubles, and yet I see in the politics in the United States in particular that there is a breakout of distrust, and it's difficult even to govern in many parts of the world. We're seeing revolutions that people don't want what they have, but they don't know what they do want. So how are we going to do that community building if there is a wave of cynicism and distrust?
Well, the cynicism seems to be on one level. The cynicism seems to be about people who put themselves in positions of authority and superiority over us. I think one of the things, as I was watching Al Jazeera, that I was really excited to hear is that in different countries, in Arabic, they were chanting a very popular slogan that we're all aware of, which is, "The people united will never be defeated." And it was just remarkable for me to hear that, because it's addressing what you're saying, which is that we've had situations for so many years in so many countries where the dictators were of the belief that they could pretty much do whatever they wanted and that people had to be, you know, had to be underneath and cooperative with them. And I think what we're seeing, which is very hopeful for me, is that we're seeing people whose commonality is, say, their nationalism, get together and say, you know what, we are not going to settle for threats anymore. You can kill this person and this person and this person, but it's going to bring us more together. It's going to make us more insistent that this can't continue to go on. And so in a lot of ways, you know, the issue of democracy is a very messy issue, and I don't think it gets easier as the countries and the sections of, that you're trying to control get farther and farther removed from the local level. But I think, again, that we need to begin to think back to earlier times when where we were primarily invested was in how our local communities were run. that we put a lot of effort into the individuals that were taking care of our streets and our neighborhoods and our towns. And we were responsible for those people in our neighborhoods and our towns. And I think the farther you get away from that neighborhood attitude, the farther you get removed from, you know, your local representatives or your local townsfolk to your state representatives and finally on the federal level, the less control that you feel and the more cynicism that people in general begin to feel as a result of that.
And here's another disconnect I'm feeling, and that is that even as the nuclear reactors in Fukushima, Japan, were smoking and threatening to blow up this week, there was a blast of big headlines in Western media saying we must build more nuclear power plants. We have to. There's no danger. The climate requires it. And the more they say that, the less I believe it. So, you know, nuclear power, it frightens people to the bone. And what does it say about leaders and about our media that they won't acknowledge those emotions are real and that they matter?
Yeah, well, I think a long time ago someone discovered that if you repeat a lie often enough that you'll get a lot of people to start believing it. And, you know, look at it this way. The nuclear industry, I just was writing on my blog, Peak Oil Blues, the nuclear industry was beginning to experience a renaissance. We were beginning to see in various blogs a description of how nuclear power was good for the environment, and in various spots there was a story about Chernobyl and how it's become sort of like an archaic kind of amusement park now that people are being taken through on tours and that sort of thing and how beautiful it is. So we were going through a shift in the propaganda, which was saying that nuclear power is really okay for the United States. And we began to see Obama beginning to okay the first nuclear power plants in 30 years. And so I think what's happened is that this experience in Japan has so completely shocked the folks that have been watching it go on, and even the Japanese themselves, that I think you have to begin a really big push in the propaganda machine to try and override this fear that people have, which, again, is a fear of an invisible toxin that kills you over time in ways that you can't measure through epidemiological studies, because they have so much to do with how much radiation that you've had in your life previously. So some people in a town who've gotten hit by radiation and who've never really been exposed to very much before might not get sick, where somebody else who's had several doses of radiation over living your life, and it's hard to avoid it, may in fact get sick. So I think when people instinctively feel something is wrong, they then become very suspicious, because they repeatedly hear government one day, like in Japan, like the Nuclear Regulatory Commission in Japan, saying we've got it under control, there's no danger to the population, and yet an hour or a day later, we see another situation in which it raises our fear level, and even we have people in power in Japan actually crying on the television, apologizing for the kinds of crises and the catastrophes that are happening. So I think the cynicism and the skepticism is good, is very, very healthy. And I frankly believe that the nuclear industry in the United States anyway has a huge challenge that I severely at this point doubt they'll be able to overcome. Locally in my area, the nuclear power plant that's about 35 miles away from me was going up for review, and it was supposedly good for 40 years. They look at it and they say, oh, it's fine for another 20 years. Well, you know what? I am going to be the first one to take a 35-mile drive to make it clear that, no, I don't want another 20 years of that reactor. And I think a lot of people are going to feel the same way as I do.
Which reactor is that?
It's Pilgrim.
Right. There's some really worrisome old plants up your way in New England. I'm thinking of Vermont Yankee. That's another ancient GE boiling water reactor, just like in Fukushima. And there's Oyster Creek in New Jersey, the nation's oldest. And, of course, there's the Indian Point reactor, another relic with a bad safety record, just 38 short miles north of New York City. you know, I've seen governors are trying to get these things closed and don't seem to be able to. Is there a growing nuclear dissent in New England?
Oh, absolutely. You know, and here's the thing I think that people don't really get is that it costs as much money to close a nuclear power plant as it does to build one. So the decision to build another nuclear power plant means that you're paying twice. And given the economics that are going on in our area, where are we going to get not only the huge amount of money to close one, but the huge amount of money to build another one simultaneously? So, you know, again, I think all of these issues that we're talking about, we have to sort of circle back to a very important point, which is that we need to be able to recognize that to live without nuclear power means that we're all going to have to power down. You can't have it both ways. You can't say, I want to use all the energy that I'm using now, and I don't want to have any other sorts of power like large-scale nuclear power plants to take care of my problem. We have to recognize that there is going to be an important interim where we're all going to have to begin to live more simply and cut back on the amount of energy that we're using to date.
And you do that personally. Now, it's only been 5 months since we ran your Peak Oil Blues speech here in Vancouver. It seems like a whole year has passed, but it's only 5 months. What have you been up to?
Well, you know, one of the things I'm excited about is that I'm just finishing up a book that I'm hoping that will be ready for my fifth anniversary of Peak Oil Blues. It's hard for me to believe that I've been running Peak Oil Blues for 5 years, starting in the end of May, but it's been the case. And one of the issues that I've been hearing a lot about is the notion that there are couples where one is really fearful of what's going on about energy and in the environment and the economic troubles that that the United States is having and really all over the world. And the other person is like, well, what's the problem? You know, there's really no issue. I don't want to really disturb my life in the way I'm living it. So I am putting together, finishing up a book called I Can't Believe You Actually Think That, A Couple's Guide to Finding Common Ground About Peak Oil, Climate Catastrophe, and Economic Hard Times. And I'm really excited about it because my take on it is a little bit different than a lot of people. I'm really looking at the idea that we in the peak oil community have to reconsider how we're approaching our spouses and really start to recognize that notions like wanting to get our spouse on board can be pretty insulting because the implication is, you know, by hook or by crook, we've got to convince them of something that they inherently disagree with. So my approach in the book is a little bit different. You know, my approach is if you married this person, if you selected them out of, you know, all of the people that you were potentially interested in, why wouldn't you respect them enough to begin to have serious conversations which allow the both of you to begin dialogue? So that's what the book's about, and I'm really excited about it coming out, and I'm offering sort of a sneak preview for folks that are interested in signing up ahead of time.
And what's your website?
It's www.peakoilblues.org/blog.
Kathy, I'd like to talk with you for about another 2 hours about the personal things that we can do, the psychological toolbox to prepare for what are going to be worse headlines to come. But we've run out of time for today. Our guest is Kathy McMahon. She's developed ways to feed our capacity for happiness and cope even in the worst of times. You can listen to our previous radio interview and Kathy's fine speech in Vancouver, Canada, by going to our Peak Oil page and the audio on demand menu right at ecoshock.org, or look for our October 29th, 2010 show in the program archive. Those are all free MP3s waiting for you. Kathy, thank you so much. It always makes me feel better to talk with you.
It was a pleasure to be here.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. The ongoing nuclear disaster in Japan is one of the most difficult stories I have ever reported on. It is also an earthquake in human affairs, with tentacles reaching out around the world, shaking up energy systems, the global economy, and the way all of us feel. Japan had the third largest economy in the world. Now that is in doubt. The big companies are still closed, corporations like Sony, Honda, and Toyota, with most facilities closed. The largest utility company, Tokyo Electric, or TEPCO, says it cannot provide enough electricity to run former manufacturing due to the loss of nuclear power reactors and damage to infrastructure. TEPCO has asked the government to institute electricity rationing and plans to continue rolling blackouts this summer when air conditioning demands are high in Japan. Many companies overseas were relying on just-in-time critical parts from Japanese companies, some of them shipped by air. For example, a General Motors plant in Louisiana has shut down, saying it cannot get critical parts. That is just the beginning for corporations all over Asia and the world who depend on Japanese exports. Food exports from Japan will also affect global markets and eventually the price you pay at the grocery store. On Tuesday, the U.S. Food and Drug Administration banned the import of fruit, vegetables, and dairy products from the four prefectures close to the damaged Daiichi reactors, Fukushima, Ibaraki, Tochigi, and Gunma. The London Telegraph newspaper quotes André-Claude Lacoste, the head of the French Nuclear Safety Authority, saying ground contamination would last for, quote, decades and decades, end quote, with expected contamination in a radius of 60 miles or 100 kilometers. All countries are checking fresh Japanese seafood for radiation. Only two samples of seawater near the plant have been reported, and both are high in radiation. The amount of contaminated seawater passing through the reactors, the spent pools, running off the radioactive debris at the site and right back into the sea is unknown but substantial. This multiple reactor accident in Japan has blown a wave of nuclear fear and criticism in the United States. Briefly, New York Governor Andrew Cuomo has demanded the end of the aging Indian Point nuclear plant. He wants it shut down. The big backup system for that reactor failed in August 1999. The U.S. Nuclear Regulatory Commission may have to reevaluate the so-called Plume Exposure Pathway Emergency Planning Zone, which is currently set at 10 miles, compared to the 50 miles recommended by U.S. authorities around Fukushima. That could be impossible and may mean some nuclear plants would have to be shut down. See the article by Kate Shepard in the March 22nd post at motherjones.com. In Texas, NRG Energy announced a probable delay of their plans to build two new reactors in South Texas with Japanese nuclear maker Toshiba. Financing is now unlikely, the company says, after the Fukushima disaster. That was reported by the Wall Street Journal. New polls show most Americans now oppose further federal funding for nuclear construction. It's very unpopular, and most people want the private corporations to pay for any accident losses instead of putting that incalculable burden on the taxpayers. The survey was by CSI/OCR, as reported by Mark Clayton of the Christian Science Monitor. Support for nuclear power in the United States has plummeted since the accident in Japan. The International Atomic Energy Agency announced radiation 1,600 times above normal in an area 20 kilometers from the Fukushima Daiichi plant. The Fukushima plant was holding more spent fuel rods than it was ever designed for, at least 4,000 fuel rods. In addition to the six fully stocked fuel ponds right next to each reactor, there is an even larger seventh pond, which is seldom reported. The Japanese originally planned to reprocess this fuel into another burnable form called MOX, but their intermediary and reprocessing facilities have run into long-term problems which have not been resolved. Like every other country, Japan has no place to put its growing nuclear waste. Reuters reported on March 22nd the first detection of radiation from the Fukushima plant in Reykjavik, Iceland. The tiny traces of radioactive iodine had spread from Japan and was expected to arrive also in France the following day. That was measured by stations set up under the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty Organization. Those measurements are supposed to be secret, but results were released by Austria. And that's just what I predicted, that radiation would travel around the Northern Hemisphere. I had some people write me and say I was wrong, but now we see that it is happening. Thank goodness it's only in small amounts so far, but that depends on whether the Japanese can bring these reactors under control, and that is still an open question, according to the IAEA. Meanwhile, thousands of nuclear refugees are sleeping in arenas and other public buildings after the mass evacuation around Fukushima. For example, 2,300 people from the town of Tishimashi are in the town of Saitama. The first makeshift school for their children was set up this week. Residents fear they will never be allowed to return.
Sinners, are you ready for a little redemption, to receive forgiveness for what we've done? The time has come to break bad habits. It's time to turn to the wind and sun. Just a little more power from above, just a little more faith, respect, and love for this old earth, our only home. It may take strength to say no to that power from below, but there's salvation in the power from above. There's a better way than barrels of oil. There's a better way than lumps of coal. There's a better way to work together. Renewable power, that's our goal.
That's our goal.
Just a little more power from above, just a little more faith, respect, and love for this old earth, our only home. It may take strength to say no to that power from below, but there's salvation in the power from above. What will we do for a better world? Get on your knees to hope and pray. Well, that's not enough unless we change. The judgment day is every day. Wars have been fought over who owns what. Lives have been lost and fortunes won. But you and I will someday win.
Cause no one owns
the wind or sun. Just a little more power from above, just a little more faith, respect, and love for this old earth, our only home. It may take strength to say no to that power from below, but there's salvation in the power from above. Just a little more power from above, just a little more faith, respect, and love for this old earth, our only home. It may take strength to say no to that power from below, but there's salvation in the power from above. Yes, there's salvation in the power from above.
That was Power from Above by New England folk singer Dan Bergson. Thank you, Dan, for all your fine music.
In the wake of the nuclear crisis, protesters hit the streets of downtown Tokyo earlier in the day, demanding that Japan get rid of its nuclear power facilities.
It's okay, they say, for the health, but we think it's very dangerous and very serious, and we are very worrying about it.
Government officials say the entire Fukushima complex will be scrapped once the emergency is resolved.
First of all, the radiation level at the west gate of the plant was 269 microsieverts, while radiation north of the service building was 3,054 microsieverts on March 20th. In American measurements, one sievert is about 100 rem. A chest X-ray is anywhere from 6 to 18 microsieverts. The lowest clearly carcinogenic level is 100 microsieverts per year. So at over 3,000 microsieverts per hour, parts of the Fukushima plant are extremely dangerously radioactive. An investigation by the Wall Street Journal shows the Daiichi plant had more serious incidents than any other large nuclear facility in Japan, even before the earthquake. It was aging and the original design had problems. Also, Japan power companies handle reactor spent fuel differently than their American counterparts. When it comes time to service a reactor, U.S. nuclear operators move only some of the still active fuel rods to the spent fuel pool, while keeping most within the much more protected reactor vessel. At Fukushima Daiichi Reactor No. 4, as with most Japanese reactors, all the hot rods were placed at once in the cooling ponds, which have no safe outer containment and depend completely on water pumping to stop a nuclear reaction. The less safe practice contributed to the serious fears about overheating in the spent fuel pool reactors of No. 5 and No. 6, but especially Reactor No. 4. It is called full core discharge, and that practice may have to be re-examined in light of this accident. I'm Alex Smith. This is Radio EcoShock. Keep tuned to our podcast, subscribe at our main page, ecoshock.org, and listen to our weekly program broadcast on 25 college and community radio stations, plus Green 960 AM, San Francisco. Thank you again for listening.